So I'm personally a lover of chaos, and it oftentimes makes for very bad presentations. So I have written a presentation so that you're not inflicted by my love of chaos. But because I do enjoy it, please feel free. If any time you have a question or you feel provoked, feel free to interrupt me. I enjoy that, actually. And also, I very much hope that we can have a discussion after I'm complete, and hopefully that makes sense.
Was this open?
I think one more. Yeah. I think he has it. This is somewhat of a. This is a. Who I am. My name is Aragorn. That's my actual name. My parents were lovers of J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm an anarchist publisher from North America. I live in California. And I'm primarily am active on the internet. And we can talk about some of my internet projects if you'd like. But one of them is called the Anarchist Library. And in the publishing world, I do a distribution called Little Black Cart and a publishing project called Arden Press. And so you can see some of my books or art books in some of the stalls. Crime Think. Yeah, the Crime Think are very pleasant. They've changed a lot over the years, but they do very good propaganda on the internet. I'm friendly with them, but politically, I think that they've become less interesting over the years. They've become much more traditional activist sort of focused, and much less focused on having like a libertine vision of how to live. Yeah. Yeah, they are less spontaneous now, and this is largely because they have like an audience who they have to pay attention to, and so I think that that's made them less exciting. I will begin. Carlo Pisacin, whose name I'm not pronouncing correctly, an early proponent of propaganda by the deed, wrote in his political treatise that ideas spring from deeds and not the other way around. The use of the bayonet in Milan has produced a more effective propaganda than 1,000 books. Bakunin, in his letter to a Frenchman in the present crisis, stated that we must spread our principles not with words, but with deeds, for this is the most popular, the most potent, and the most irresistible form of propaganda. Thus begins the anarchist justification for propaganda by action rather than writing. This presentation is intended as this history, both through the early period and the later illegalist period. After the history, we will turn towards today and our similar and dissimilar efforts towards getting the word out about anarchism and our rage against the current order. If all goes well, we will establish some structure around a conversation on the issue that goes deeper than denunciation or glorification, perhaps towards talking about general principles of the kind of actions we would like to take today to spread our message. Part 1, the first period of active propaganda. The first period was one of high optimism. As long as the current system appears invulnerable, the thesis states, there could be no possibility of anarchist revolution. Therefore, if one could remove a head of state or an important industrialist, the population would see the fallibility of the throne or of the entire system. In this weakness lay the only possibility that man would seize control of the apparatus of control. My first story is of Alexander Berkman, with some quotes from Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. On June 28, 1892, Henry Clay Frick attempted to crush the union at the Carnegie Homestead steel plant by locking the workers out of the plant and one of their furnaces. The next day, he locked the union out of the rest of the plant. A high fence topped with barbed wire was completed that day and used to seal out the workers. Sniper towers with searchlights were constructed near the mill building, and high-pressure water cannons were placed at each entrance. Alongside this fortress, the Pinkertons were used who were a private security force, and attempted to land under cover of darkness. The agents attempted to disembark, and shots were fired. Conflicting testimony exists as to which side fired first. The Pinkerton agents aboard the barges were then fired into the crowd, killing 2 and wounding 11. The crowd responded in kind, killing 2 and wounding 12. Homestead's striker shot. Pinkertons have killed women and children. She speaks in a quick, jerky manner. Her words ring like the cry of a wounded animal. The melodious voice tinged with the harshness of bitterness, the bitterness of helpless agony. I take the paper from her hands. In growing excitement, I read the vivid account of the tremendous struggle. The homestead strike, or more correctly, the lockout. I pass the paper to Fedya. The girl glances at me. We sit in silence, each busy with his own thoughts. Only now and then we exchange a word, a searching, significant look. On July 23rd, 1892, Alexander Berkman went into Frick's office, who was the industrialist responsible for the lockout, armed with a gun and a sharpened steel file. He shot Frick 3 times, then grappled with him and stabbed him in the leg. A group of nearby workers came to Frick's rescue, beat Berkman unconscious. He then served 14 years in prison. The story of Ravuchel, with comments from his trial statement. In 1891, at Formies, in the north of France, the newly designed Lebel's machine gun was used against a peaceful May Day rally in which women and children were carrying flowers and palms. Casualties there numbered 14 dead and 40 wounded. The same day at Cliché, south of Formes, police attacked a 6-man anarchist labor rally. The workers defended themselves with pistols and were given hard long terms at labor. Anarchy is the obliteration of property. No more war, no more disputes, no more jealousy, no more theft, no more murder, no more court system, no more police, no more administration. Ravuchel took retribution for the Cliché defendants by bombing the homes of the presiding judge, and this is March 11th, 1892, then the prosecutor, and during the same month, he bombed the barracks in which the army resided, who was responsible for the slaughter of the innocents at Formes. These 3 attentats caused extensive property damage, but no deaths. If I speak, it's not to defend myself for the acts of which I'm accused. It is society alone which is responsible, since by its organization, it sets man in continual struggle against one another. Ravuchel was pointed out to police by a waiter in a restaurant. And then, on the night before his trial, this restaurant was bombed, killing its owner. In fact, don't we see today, in all classes and all positions, people who desire, I won't say the death, but the ill fortune of their like, if they can gain advantage from this? On July 11th, 1892, Ravuchel was publicly guillotined and became a romanticized symbol of desperate revolt, and a number of songs were composed in his honor. Well then, in a society where such events occur, there's no reason to be surprised about the kind of acts for which I'm blamed, which are nothing but the logical consequence of the struggle for existence that men carry on who are obliged to use every means available in order to live. Political assassinations and attacks upon the bourgeoisie became a commonplace of French anarchism. It struck terror in the hearts of the bourgeoisie. Mere political assassination they could understand. It was part and parcel of the French ruling class game. The idea of attacks upon the bourgeoisie, though, non-politicians, threw them into alarm. It was a terror quite unequaled in other countries where kings, queens, and presidents were assassinated. It was well understood by the French proletariat. They began to sing of the assassinations, La Rochelle, and to remind the bourgeois that they were not all-powerful. The employer set to sack his militants heard the songs about Rochelle or Emile Henry whistled in his factory and decided a few francs extra a day would not ruin him. This is from The Truth of the Bonneau Gang by Albert Meltzer. At the end, of course, of the period of active propaganda, or what's called now propaganda by the deed, heads of state were killed in a variety of countries, including Russia, the United States, Spain. But the consequence in terms of prosecution was so severe that anarchists, by and large, decided that the strategy was ineffective. And more importantly, that the optimism of the idea of transforming society through removing the heads of state was perhaps misguided. The second period of active propaganda. The second wave of active propaganda was less optimistic. Society as a whole seemed not just totally cowed, but happily so. As a result, many anarchists examined the social theories of revolution and determined that the project was a spook. It was an illusion that made smart people chase phantoms like unionism or other mass social enterprises. This line of reasoning was inspired by Max Stirner and turned the anarchist activities inspired in such a way towards the satisfaction of the actors rather than the illusions of the people or the revolution. The Bonneau Gang, in their words. Jules Bonneau, in his 30s, spent 3 years as a truck mechanic in the army. As a result, he became one of the first to specialize in stolen cars, altering and reshaping bodies, fitting new license plates. But like many French workers of the period, he could not get work. He failed as a bourgeois, and went from failed bourgeois existence to the ranks of the lumpen proletariat. Aren't you all sick and tired of this wretched existence? Here we are, flogging a stolen bike here, and pushing a few dud coins there, or even stooping to picking up wages after a long week's work in the factory. And what do we get out of it? Nothing. You all talk about revolution and illegality, but what do you do about it? The crime spree, which the so-called Bonneau Gang, which is only named as such due to not due to Bonneau's leadership, but due to his willingness to talk to the press, lasted only 6 months. From December 21st, 1921, till May 14th, 1922. In this time, they stole less than 100,000 francs, but did rob several banks, kill a wealthy homeowner and his maid, and several police. The police agency assigned to kill them was grown in this period by 800,000 francs, and the bank robbed by the gang offered another 100,000 to the gangs captured, and was which was largely given to the wife of one of the officers killed by Bonneau. We'll burn off our last round against the cops, and if they don't care to come, we certainly know how to find them. The gang who made it to trial were largely sentenced to the guillotine, or life in prison, except for the greatest revolutionary tourist of all time, Victor Serge. At the same time as the second wave in France used Stirner's ideas to argue for an illegal life as an anarchist one, in Argentina and Spain, practitioners of expropriative anarchism took from the bourgeoisie as a way of financing revolutionary activities, anarchist propaganda, and the release of anarchist prisoners. Famous members of these groups include Derudi, Giovanni, and Francisco Escasso. If the second wave of illegalist anarchists had little faith in inspiring the people to action due to their activities, then the current generation has none at all. Inspired more by punk rock than a thinker from the 19th century, the current set of illegalists no longer talk to the media except to curse it. The actions range from social rage in the context of mass globalization protests where anarchists break windows of corporate institutions and the safety of numbers, to solidarity actions that use property destruction as a punctuation mark to free speech that would otherwise go unnoticed. In article after article by the mainstream press, anarchist destruction of property is confused with violence. This confusion is purposeful, of course, and directly attributable to the central aim of the Western liberal conception of what is at the center of social life, which is property. Anarchists who decry the confusion of violence with property destruction are arguing for an entire conceptual shift that will take far more pithy slogans than pithy slogans or the truth to be convincing. And this convincing is not just a matter of being misrepresented by the media that is in more or less open conflict with us. The current social order rests on the control of the land and its material resources. Attacks against that foundation are attacks against the whole, even if they're weak and pathetic ones. Even if they're the only ones that anarchists, in their atomized and alienated state, are capable of accomplishing. Perhaps there will always be an irreconcilable conflict between us and society, no matter the form or shape of that society. Perhaps, if anarchists were to reshape their relationship to society towards one of hostility, we would see that assimilation is the underlying drive of society. Social bodies consume. The classical anarchist argument is that the state is at war with society, which is a categorical good. But perhaps society is not a categorical good at all. Instead, society is the imposition of its value system, its lies made true, onto the social body, composed through violence. To bring this back to our topic at hand, in the current time there's no possibility of a legal action done by anarchists to materially impact society. At best, it benefits the actors in an identical fashion as being able to afford high-end camping gear, fine food, and travel. At worst, it means the deaths of our not enemies, such as in the case of the burning of the Marfin Bank. The history of anarchist illegalism has been one of diminishing returns. As society has become further and further rationalized, it leaves the people within it fewer ways to experience anything other than its rationality. This is not an argument for illegalism's inverse, aka mass social action, as this has been entirely circumscribed also, but a plea. This plea is to see the beauty of the illegalists that is in the actions of every freedom loving person, every anarchist. Sorry, I apologize. I had a brain aneurysm a few months ago, so it makes my tongue a little lazy. This plea is to see the beauty of the illegalists, that in their actions, every freedom loving person. Every anarchist can see the future we desire, one where kings fear to sleep, banks burn, and society is no longer a dirty word. That's it. Now, I'm happy. I would love to talk this through, and we can use more examples from illegalist history. This is really very much an introduction to a conversation we're going to have now. So. Questions. Go ahead. You're referring to Thoreau's civil disobedience? Oh, thank you. So your point is that
civil disobedience is the way society is working against the laws that they are making, and that it's legal to do so. You know, when that they have atomic bombs, people are against mass destruction, it's legal to vote. protest against those weapons.
I'm not sure the connection, but I'll pretend I understand it and speak to it. So, to some extent, the point that I'm arguing is that what we call illegalist anarchist activity has had diminishing returns over time, probably because the liberal framework that we live in is one that does accept that the ways that laws get tweaked and that change happens is through the sort of civil disobedience that you're referring to. I absolutely agree. And part of the problem with the anarchist illegalism, to some greater or lesser extent, is not only is it far less optimistic today, right? It's a broken window or a shoplifted jacket, or breaking. Yeah, sure. But that possibly it was a participation in a liberal framework from the very onset. In other words, it was willingness to participate in the same society that it was attempting to change. Okay, so then you're speaking to one of the points that I was making about liberal society. So anarchists have spent a lot of time focusing on this question of violence being something that you do to hurt a person rather than an object, and I think that that's fair, and it's fine to have this sort of semantic argument. My counterpoint, and I think it's an important counterpoint, is that from the perspective of the system that we live in, they are identical. Because at the core of the system that we live in, right, not one that I chose, is property values. And so violence and life, we would like to believe that violence is only something that hurts life. But the truth is, within the context of the system that tells the stories in the media, that prosecutes us in the courts, that for them they are identical. Life and property are the same thing. I mean, but most anarchists are not interested in questions of legality. I mean, it's irrelevant. I mean the entire first generation, but the entire first generation.
Can you sum up what he said? We can't hear back here.
So he said that Berkman in Berkman's life admitted to two things, right? One, that he failed at killing Frick, which of course is factually true, and then also that he failed at the task, like the general idea of killing Frick, this industrialist, was more or less a conceptual failure. So I'm happily speaking in the Netherlands and not in the U.S., where I would be investigated and persecuted for what I'm about to say. But the killing of the president of the United States can from an anarchist perspective, be argued as an objective success. I mean, we can you know, whatever, argue whether that's fair or not. But the killing of the president or a variety of other European leaders, that's the extent of the success. Obviously, the failure is that there was another leader eager to take their place. And then furthermore, the prosecution of all radical political people after these acts happened was tremendous, right? The example that I used of the Bonneau gang, which is that the Bonneau gang stole 100,000 francs, the police force gained 800,000 in the 6 months that it took to hunt them down, right? In other words, to the extent to which we're still encased in this logic of a state that commands the resources, that commands the monopolization, not just of violence, but of resources, these are always going to be the stories that we're telling. So to that extent, I'm not arguing for propaganda, but for a new, you know, 2.0 propaganda by the deed where we kill more. What instead I'm saying is that to some extent we've been locked in the same liberal framework that he correctly pointed out, where we're arguing about what's the definition of violence rather than perhaps what's the definition of success.
And now I see it like smashing a bank is not personal. That's shifting it to an institutional, faceless, abstract fight. And where now I think we're a bit too afraid to say, hey, you make this choice in life, or you choose not to make this choice in life, and therefore you are subscribing to the logic that is, as you say, assimilating anybody that doesn't make certain choices in life. And I don't know if, this was just a comment that I wanted to make, but perhaps in these two things lacks actually the courage of the conflict between people, no? And we see conflict as being, like, we direct our conflict these days towards either the mass of people is probably the most personal that we get it, but if not, we direct it towards a bank or, like, whatever, an institution that, you know, without even talking about the head of the institution or the people behind it, we talk about, like, just these baseless things that I think that are lacking in the courage of the conflict, the real conflict of being looking somebody in the eye and being like, you are making these choices, you are subscribing to this lifestyle, this political idea, and therefore you are my enemy or whatever. And I'm not saying, okay, then you should put a bomb in their face, but you know, I think that the accountability of the responsibility of your choices is actually a dialogue that we're reading.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the in the U.S. there was this person Ted Kaczynski, who he created these beautiful handcrafted boxes from local woods, and he lovingly sent them to industrialists and their secretaries throughout the country, and inside of each of these boxes were varieties of explosives, and some of them dismembered people, and a few of them killed people. And in some of his writing afterwards, he said that the people that are destroying the earth have names and addresses, and that was actually one of the things that's been pointed to time and time and again in the U.S. as being a demonstration of how crazy he was. As if that's not true, because of course it is. And I think that's an interesting point, and maybe speaks to something that to implying the question of, well, like, what was the qualitative difference between early 20th or late 19th century and today, which is that to, by and large, we have surrounded ourselves with ideologies and labels rather than maybe personal responsibility. It's really interesting.
In Spain, and particularly in Barcelona, throughout like the 1990s, a lot of anarchists there. Specifically chose a course, a strategic course of action centered on expropriating banks, attacking factory owners, attacking the paramilitary to back up factory owners, as well as politicians and cops. Was at times like a major part of the struggle. For example, when the CNT had to go underground because there was a big rush between the dictatorship, the existence of a labor struggle in Barcelona and other hotspots was predicated on their ability to move into clandestine struggles, which was focused around propaganda by unions. Like the very possibility to spend civil war is inconceivable without those propaganda by union actions, and also the other stuff that was in 1905 and 1908, the Jewish anarchist struggle that folks learned, that actually kind of exploded in a way when finally like some young crazy anarchists like went into the synagogue, like his mom was Muslim, went into the synagogue, killed the local factory owner who had just been responsible for like the deaths of several workers, and all like the young radical Jewish people in town were like, yeah, and just like started this way of like killing these poor factory owners. And their failure actually because of course in the wrong time frame or any stuff was going on. They failed, but they were able to sustain a level of strength to survive the repression that could be levied against them locally. But they didn't fall until like the Russian Empire like centered on Bialystok as the hotspot of rebellion and like mobilized lots of their national resources to crush it. And that, if anything, is just more of a sign that the struggle wasn't strong elsewhere. So they could have just not.
I'm just going to review for the people who can't hear. Peter made the contentious statement about the CNT being using some of these methods and it being somewhat necessary for the Spanish Civil War, highly contentious. And then the next person is basically making the argument that propaganda by the need, hand in hand with the mass movement, is a useful strategy, which is also highly contentious. But continue.
That, but I wondered if that was one way, that one contentious way, and the different ways the Bono gang were kind of acting in some kind of that pessimism as you described it. Is that because there wasn't a particular climate of anarchist ideas and action that was behind
Well, I think that you're both bringing up exactly a crystallizing principle. In other words, to what extent do we feel as though this sort of outlandish or spectacular illegal actions, right, which obviously framing ourselves in terms of law and order for me feels like a mistake, but to what extent do these sorts of actions, could they participate in something that looks like the transformation of society? And I think that in almost any measure, everyone's going to say absolutely, like if society were to radically transform, it's going to involve incredible amounts of things that look really different than what we have now. They may not look like bank robberies because there may be no paper money in a few years, but I think that goes to that question. The second part is important, which is the second part of your point, which is that by and large, I think by the end of the first period, the first wave of propaganda by the deed, most people did not believe that their illegal actions had anything to do with social revolution. By and large, they believed that social revolution was a spook. In other words, that it was an illusion that we use to keep ourselves warm at night, that we dream of, that we allow ourselves the illusion to have as like a maybe even a core principle to who we are, but that has nothing to do with the lives that we're going to lead. And so for them, robbing banks was about the francs that they received as a result. I think that's important. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's absolutely. I mean, again, if we were to look at today as an example, right, after 9/11, FBI resources in the United States went entirely towards the prosecution of domestic terrorism, quote unquote. And the number of bank robberies between 2002 and 2005 went shot through the roof. Right? It was like one of the it was the glory days of unprosecutable bank robbery in North America. Did that money go to do anything that we would consider particularly interesting? Absolutely not. But it is perhaps for those of you who are inclined useful information to think about the fact that states are fallible and finite, not infallible and infinite, which perhaps is a lesson from the period. I'm happy to have someone disagree strongly. I apologize for having my presentation be so short. The last month I've been traveling, and my presentations have all involved a translator, which makes you go more than twice as slow, so I thought that actually there might have been translation today. I apologize. Okay. Yeah, I mean, but that's been true for several decades, actually. And not quite legal. Only legal if you're a banker. Spanish. I do agree, but again, I was just having a conversation earlier with someone who, where we were talking essentially about the fact that anarchism means, and this is a word that's even hard to say, responsibility, and by and large, especially in North America, responsibility has entirely left the discourse as something that you're allowed to say without it being somewhat embarrassed. Because by and large, the focus is on a lifestyle that's a really pleasant lifestyle. It's a very it's a fun lifestyle. And then when people are done living the lifestyle, they leave it behind. They put it in their memory book as something that maybe they'll share with their grandchildren. And then they move on to with the rest of their bourgeois existences. And so, yeah, I would absolutely agree with him on that level. I mean, I hate to say it, though, that I'm not exactly sure what I would say is, like, the replacement. In other words, like, the actions of this one person who could fund a propaganda movement, or the CNT who, you know, were responsible for this civil war or this revolution that happened that all of us are inspired by. Like, to some extent, these beautiful things, right? Bank robberies, removals of heads of state, etc. You know, sadly, by and large, these things are things that we can only talk about as historical. That today we have not developed, and I fear to say that maybe we cannot develop a practice that is nearly as inspiring to even the people who are alive today. And that's partially why I'm motivated to talk about the topic with each of you. Well, I mean, I'll speak to part, kind of the first part of your question first, which is that that I don't think the problem is that we lack ideas. I think the anarchist ideas continue to be, anarchists continue to be some of the most interesting and creative people that I've ever met in my life. The problem is that the state has rationalized so much of our existences, and not just the state, but the state in loving embrace with, you know, exchange relationships and all the rest, that they have made our creativity less and less relevant as like a thing that sparks more interesting things. So the responsibility on some level, this lack of responsibility, I don't blame on us for not being more serious revolutionaries. I see as like a coping mechanism with the fact that we lead lives where we have so few options and alternatives. So I tend not to be as maybe judgmental about that as I sound. I bemoan the fact because it means that I'm growing older and older, and the people around me are staying the same age.
I read once a critique on, not a critique, but a comment on Bono and trying to, maybe, I mean, these days we quite romanticize these illegalists now that go around shooting cops, robbing banks, and running away in cars. But the point is that, I mean, at the time, Bono and the gang, and in the way that they did all their expropriation was actually quite technologically advanced compared to the state. And so, therefore, and not to say that in the end they didn't get caught anyway, and that what happened to them wouldn't be the exact same thing that happened to us if we did this these days, but I just see a very big cloud of omnipresent technology and unperceivable technology that is really working as preventive repression on and doing the work of integration into the logic of the state and society that is actually, yeah, one of the biggest differences between now and then.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to look to the people who are the most like Bono in the sense of taking advantage of the early stages of a technology where there's a possible lead to what we can do with it versus what big systems do with it, I think you really can actually look at people who are Linux hackers, who are doing open source software, who are running pirate radio stations as being some of the few people who are thinking about this problem. But as actually your criticism implies, many of those people obsess about the techniques and don't spend very much time thinking about the more interesting applications, especially within a social context. And perhaps this is the problem that we can say was true of Bono Gang. I mean, like for me, when I was thinking about this presentation, I thought it was really important to talk about the fact that it lasted 6 months. In other words, from the day that they said, let's rob a bank, to the day that Bono was dead, was 6 months. And most of us have not chosen that life. I mean, admit it or not, you know. And I think that's very important. And so to answer your questions, I'm not sure that interest, or to kind of take it in a different direction, I'm not sure that interesting work that could be done in the future. I don't think that the Bono of the 21st century looks like someone who works on computer systems and moves digits from Switzerland to somewhere else. I don't actually think that those people, by and large, they look more like people moving money around. They look like capitalists. I don't know what else to say other than that.
I think that the whole link with hacktivism and the hacker scene is quite incorrect, because most parts of that, they don't see them in any way as themselves as illegalists, because what they do, they think, should actually never have been illegal in the first place.
You're saying black hat hackers?
For example, black hat hackers. Well, maybe black hat hackers are one of the few exceptions.
You're saying people who break EU LAs? Yeah, the point that I was making was actually, I prefaced it by saying, if you want to look to the people who are on the leading edge of technologies that systems of control haven't fully rationalized, these are the people to talk to. I don't actually think that you should look to a Linux hacker for a political education or for... Usually hackers are referred to, well, the first thing is hacker is actually a term of contention, but leaving that aside, there's white hat hackers, gray hat hackers, and black hat hackers. Essentially, a black hat hacker breaks systems for their, either just for the pleasure of breaking them, or for their benefit. That's essentially a black hat hacker. I mostly agree with you, and what's funny about for those of you who don't know this person, we represent the two sides of American analysis, the positive, every cloud has a silver lining, and the for me every rainbow has a dark hue. So I think if I were going to pull out something that I think is practical out of what you're saying, it would be that I really do wish that people who politically I disagree with very strongly, which they're in the U.S. I think that our political disagreements feel like they're a little stronger than I've met so far in Europe, but of course different. That I wish that we could talk about something other than politics sometimes, because what tends to happen is that, okay, you believe that the worker struggle is going to make mass revolution, and I don't. And I guess that's the end of the meeting. Good night. And so what I draw out of that is that when there was more of a combination of something we would call a social movement and something we would call lifestyleism today, if we accepted Murray Bookchin's framing of the conversation, which we do not, then perhaps things could be more interesting again. It's a good dream. I join you in your dream. Yeah.
How would you place within this context the unscrupulous movements of the 70s that did not see themselves as
Marxist-Leninists?
Well, no, also anarchists. Like, and also, for instance, in Greece right now, or like following the same part as being a different facet of our social struggle, which, in, as far as my love, knowledge goes, maybe with some limitation, Bono was giving money away to worker struggles, but was not doing it for that, and like it was very individualist. But how do you place these struggles that are for a social struggle in the context of where you're talking about?
Yeah, it's that's actually a really interesting question. I guess I apologize for saying this ahead of time because I wish that I didn't think this, but I tend to feel as though most of those groups are part of the diminishing return argument. In other words, what they're accomplishing again in a social aggregate sort of sense is very, very small. And the example I'll use is I just left Greece yesterday, and so a week ago when I was there, there was a shootout where essentially some cops stopped two people on a motorcycle, and they opened fire on the police, which is very rare in the Greek context. And one of the people was injured, and the other grabbed the cop car and drove away and got away, and is still on the run. And these were kids. When I say kids, they were like 19 years old. Like, they were very young people, and it's funny that right now in the Greek newspapers they're referring to them as the pistolero with a sombrero or something, like, because he had a big floppy hat on and the person who got away. Anyways, and then 2 weeks prior to that, there was an attempted firebomb that was not claimed by any group, but that was an attempted firebomb of a police station that ended up injuring 3 total non-combatants. So the people involved in the shootout were part of a conspiracy of Cells of Fire, and it has not been translated into English yet. But essentially, the week after the shooting happened, in other words, just earlier, I guess last week, like Monday, conspiracy released a statement basically saying that the first chapter of their story was over. In other words, that they were no longer going to be doing active propaganda publicly, and instead were going to be doing it on the inside. By which the implication is, this is a 20-page manifesto, the implication is that all of them have been arrested. So conspiracy of Cells of Fire lasted 18 months. So mostly I see something, their story, as being one of the diminishing returns. If we were then to go to the 70s and talk about, you know, the airplane hijackings, the assassinations, the kidnappings of the Italian and German direct action groups or armed struggle groups, I guess I'm just not sure within the context of social change that you can talk about anything other than diminishing returns. In other words, I just feel as though the encroachment of how much life has been rationalized in modern technological society has just become closer and closer to complete. and that it's only on these fringes, right, of which Greece almost defines the fringest fringe of social life in the technocracy. And I think that the individual actions, by and large, are very personally inspiring for me. I am very excited by them. I can only imagine a life where it would be possible to imagine shooting it out with the cops and getting away in their car. But from the context of the social movement, which is not language I normally use, but within the context of like what I think is useful or interesting, it's hard not to just say diminishing returns and that they're by and large strategies of failure. Beautiful failure. I think that's fair. I don't think that's a hostile.
No.
I mean, I don't think that's a hostile statement at all. I agree with that. Absolutely. I mean, perhaps I said that in my preface by saying that I'm a personal lover of chaos, and so when we start processes of constraint and confirmation, I think that that's a fairly nice definition. I mostly don't disagree with you. I think I would say I didn't use them as the reason whether diminishing returns. When I refer to diminishing returns, I refer to the difference between killing the head of state and shooting a police officer. Like, to me, that's diminishing returns. By and large, I mean, you know, again, I'm not arguing that our goal or that there's really any particular awesome thing to get out of killing a head of state. I strongly advise against it. When we talk about strategy, like the strategy of social transformation, to where are we theoretically when we conceive of such a thing, And when you refer to the hundreds of actions within the Greek context, generally you're making an argument about escalation that uses an insurrectionary anarchist theoretical framework that refers to ruptures, expanding ruptures, and maintenance and escalation of tension. And so if you're going to accept that theoretical framework or even make any argument kind of in that space at all, I'm not sure that you can refer to Greece at all in this conversation, because it's essentially a culture that is like this. In other words, let's put it differently. I don't totally agree that the criticism of the militants of Conspiracy of Cells was just along the kind of fine line that you drew it. I think that I agree that people make that criticism, but generally just that people don't like the idea of named groups doing these actions. In other words, it's a simpler point. And but that no one was necessarily against the actions themselves. And so as a result, the most contentious thing that's happened in the Greek space as of late was not the people gunning it out with the cops, but was the firebombing of a police station where civilians were injured. And so within that political context, let's pull it back a year. When the bank was burned last year, killing three people, that totally deflated the anarchist movement in Greece, period. And it essentially has not recovered since then. The number of people who come out and who are active within their own circles, the numbers are all down 25% and more. And that's even after some of the positive things of Syntagma Square. So I don't just want to talk about Greece, because the two of us are the ones who maybe are closest to us or whatever. The point about diminishing returns is that the extent to which this sort of propaganda by the deed itself, or active propaganda, which is the term I preferred, that active propaganda is not necessarily accomplishing very much other than exciting us. Or some other things that are very small. Like one of the points that I made is that I feel as though active propaganda forces people or interests people in reading the manifestos that go along with the broken windows, right? In other words, in the U.S. context, and specifically in this website that I run, many people will take an action in their town, write a manifesto about the action. No one would even read the manifesto if it weren't for the fact that they broke a window or smashed an ATM or whatever. And I to me, that doesn't feel like not only do we not have free speech any longer, the only time we can be heard at all between one another is if we break something. I don't know. Sorry, it just the context feels very diminished. And I use the state as a shorthand, but yeah. Listening to people
still have some doubts or some anger or some rage and see a window smashed, and they're interested in, you know, smashing the window. And that could be the case when there is some, indeed, economic tension, rupture, whatever. And that seems to be increasingly happening in Europe in many countries.
See, I feel as though, I'll just say it straight. I'm not a Marxist, and these arguments are exactly why there is always reason to destroy the system that exists. There is never more tension. I mean, sure, we can quantify crisis in some sort of economic gaze, but there is always enough reason to rage against the system as it exists. And perhaps I say this only as an anarchist, but I feel as though before I ever knew about Marx, I knew about anger, and I knew about control, and I knew about all of these things. And so for me, this is the more crisis doesn't make the window breaking more poignant. But with that said, I do tend to agree that we always have to be paying attention to the certain situation. I'm not sure the situation in Greece. Like, the only thing that's different about Greece than other countries is that the population, I think, is more poor in general than many of the other European countries. But, you know, this crisis that we're talking about with them, it's a 25-year-old crisis. They've had huge debt forever, long before the EU. Did you still want to? Someone had their hand up back there. Did you still want to talk?
Yeah. I like what you're saying about the idea of the mentioned firms, but I think that the logic of that is quite good, because you can look at like violent direct action and say, well, what results does this have? I think if you take that logic, then at least for us, you know, violent direct action is, you know, we just have to rule it out completely. We're never going to be, at least in the short term, we're never going to be in a position for achieving anything from violent action. I mean, the state's just far too strong for us to ever be in that position of actually carrying out violent action and receiving something from it. But I think the other kind of point you were saying about how it becomes more of an emotional thing and more of a lifestyle thing to be, you know, that kind of violent action, that's something which I can sympathise with, because it's something, you know, if I imagine myself, you know, I don't know, like having a shift out of the cops, it's a good fantasy, and it's something that seems nice. But that kind of worries me, the fact that I think that, because I'm thinking, well, you know, society is becoming more and more militarized, and more young people are, you know, playing violent computer games and, you know, really realistic games, which are really as if it's a training for combat. And I'm thinking maybe that kind of culture of militarism is seeping through into the anarchist movement, in the sense that people are saying, well, I'm playing, you know, Call of Duty and it's great fun, but I don't really like the idea of being an American soldier in Iraq, but maybe I can be an anarchist soldier in, you know, whatever urban setting. And that kind of worries me, that it's just a part of a militarization of society.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I think the way you pointed, it's going totally wrong. Then they just want to act violent and in a military way and go shooting around people, you know, just in the game, without any basic reasons, you know, without reasons behind it, you know, just because. Yeah. And you can have a lot of aggression in yourself and you start destroying things, you know, without any reason, because you're angry at the system, you know, when there is no context
I, you know, actually where I actually want to respond to your statement is I think that perhaps the weakness, one of the biggest weaknesses of anarchism, has always been simply the desire or the belief that people are good means that we should transform society so that that goodness is the way in which we deal with one another. I personally don't believe in human nature. If I did, I would not say that it's good or evil. I would say that it's complicated. It's complex. And so, as a result, our to the extent to which we followed Marxism as a revolutionary strategy, we've accepted the rhetoric that they've never practiced, but the rhetoric of certain sorts of strategic models. And so the reason that I follow the line of diminishing returns is not to say that there is not a strategy to be, some useful strategy to be drawn from the tactics of anarchist history. There's absolutely lots of useful strategy to be drawn from that. But it might not be strategy for how to transform society. It might be strategy like that's used by the Seattle Solidarity Network to confront landlords and bosses by direct, scary, human face-to-face confrontation. Right? It might be the lesson that in dealing with the people who I care for in my life, that that there's other ways in which we can have interactions other than just like big long meetings and dialogue. So I still think that there's a lot to be drawn from the spark from a strategic perspective. And then separate from that, and I just want to emphasize it because I think it's really important. Beautiful things are beautiful. And I
we're the wrong way.
I strongly disagree with that statement. It confuses a metaphor with reality. It's a nice metaphor. I think poetic, and it sounds, it makes some sort of balanced sense, and I'm zen enough to appreciate that, and nice rock formations and the rest. But that's ridiculous. The actual argument is that the British were never kicked out of Ireland. That's crazy talk. And even if they were, that's not an example of a structure being removed. It's like imagining that the barbarians raised Rome and then the Enlightenment happened. I mean, many, many things happened in between, nor did they actually burn Rome to the ground. But again, the balance statement is very nice. I just tend to see the life that I lead and the structures that are around me as being far more complicated and insane and intractable, and that I willingly participate in while I just am disgusted by them and all the rest. But again, I just yeah. Just to use the example of the Bonneau gang, while certain officials did not benefit from the events of November 1999 in Seattle, by and large the police department was expanded 3-4-fold after the events of Seattle. It was an incredible boon. So I'll tell the story from a different perspective. There are certain activists in the Bay Area who have benefited greatly from the quote-unquote Battle of Seattle. They have written books. They have done many, many interviews where they have talked about the importance and the relevance and the existential changes that happened in America because of this so-called Battle of Seattle. Those activists did not actually, I mean, beyond those activists, there was no mass movement. I hate to say it this way. There have been movements against these sorts of events, these encroaching multinational meetings and all the rest. But that really can't be confused with the movement against the practices. I mean, their practices go far beyond their meetings, and by and large, their practices have been unimpeded. No, I agree. Many nice petitions have been written. And banners dropped. Turtle costumes made. Absolutely. Creativity. No, that I totally agree. I mean, some people don't believe that. I mean,
did you see what happened at the GH220 in France? They were supposed to be moving. You see what happened in Copenhagen? If there had been such a movement, it's gone. Copenhagen, I mean, ordered 100,000 people on the street. I mean,
you just jump in. But I'm not sure that's the frame of reference. Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'll try to put this, I'll put this in a positive light, which is that anarchists, by and large, are amazingly creative, right? I have seen magical things happen from the creative minds of anarchists and from this set of principles and ideas that we share. when we are maybe lacking in creativity, we do the same thing that we did before. We try to do it over and over again, maybe better, with the belief that we're going to get different results. And this is, of course, you know, what I would refer to when I would point to this response of globalization meetings in the way that we have, is that, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, it's long since past its expiration date, and we just haven't come up with another newer way to approach these sorts of problems. But perhaps, yeah, perhaps this isn't, perhaps bombs isn't the solution. I hate to say this because, I mean, I think right now we have a lot to learn about the occupations of North Africa, Spain, and Greece right now. I think that this is what we have to be paying attention to. If an occupation of the city center were to happen in the U.S., besides from the fact that we have no commons because we learned that lesson from Europe, but if something similar were to happen in the U.S., radicals would lose their shit. They would have no idea how to handle regular people who don't do activism coming out and all of a sudden actively moving towards a transformation of our government. And I think that's in the next 5 years, the next radicals you meet at the, you know, 2 years from now here are going to be people who are inspired by that movement, guaranteed. Just like the people who are 10 years younger than me all came out of the Seattle period. It's just so there it is. Right now, it is something around direct democracy in city squares, and I don't like it because personally I'm not for direct democracy, but I think it's incredibly important, and like a laser beam, we should be examining it and tearing it apart beyond just kind of surface level criticisms of the fact that they use flags or talk about pacifism. I think that's enough. Oh, no, one more.
Oh, all right. I have a question. In the three stages, in the first stage, the anarchists were still positive about the good of society versus the evil of the state. And in the second stage, they lost this whole belief. And in the third stage...
Although that's not totally the case, as totally the examples of the Argentinians and the Spanish.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk about the third stage, because it seems to me there was also talk about the really repressive apparatus of the state, and I'm missing sort of judgment on what we do with the society, and that is that even still there, or is that why radicals lose their shit if all of a sudden they have to interact with people doing things, or what's happening?
Well, I mean, my only slight correction to that question would be people who occupy squares are not necessarily doing something. I mean, let's be fair to our own politics. But so my point about the third is mostly to talk about this existential diminishing returns. In other words, rather than living a life of crime so that I can fully commit to my passions, right, which would be an unfair shortcut of the second wave. Today, by and large, when people are involved in expropriation, it's usually done in the most egotistic way, and is usually done as individualistically as possible. Or if we talk about violence, right, broadly stated, as violence against in the sense of violence is against inanimate objects, is usually done not because we believe that it's going to transform the corporations that we attack, but because we believe that the message that we have to say about the corporations that we attack will be heard because we have broken a window. Thank you very much. And I'm happy to talk to people one-on-one if you'd like to yell at me.